Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, November 7th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Before we jump into our extra special interview today, I want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible and 100% free to download for everyone who wants to listen. First, I'll give a shout out to those of you who have pledged your support by going to patreon.com/talknerdy. If you want to sign up to be a patron, you can find out all the information right there. So I want to give a specific shout out this week to Phil T-Bear, Ron Kanoblock, Pedro Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell, among others. There are so many who pledge your support every week, and I really thank you from the bottom of my heart. There are a lot of other ways to support the show, like visiting my website at carasantamaria.com, rating and reviewing on iTunes, and visiting the Talk Nerdy store, where you can find some really cool stuff, including hardcover copies of the children's book that I wrote the foreword to. It's called Tiny Thinkers, Charlie and the Tortoise. And you can order signed copies by me right there at carasantamaria.com, amongst all sorts of other stuff. If you use the offer code CHARLIE, that's C-H-A-R-L-I-E, you will get, I think it's 10% off your entire order. All right, guys, I'm really excited about this week's episode. I had a chance to have a chat with Dr. Christine Corbett Moran. Now, she is a postdoc at Caltech in astrophysics, but she's on sabbatical right now because she spent over 10 months at the South Pole Research Station. She wintered over in the South Pole, and I was able to get some time with her on the satellite phone so that we could have a chat before she leaves. It's absolutely fascinating. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Christine Corbett Moran. Christine, I am so excited to be connected to you. How many thousands of miles away are you from Los Angeles right now?
That's a good question. I think I'm about, I think I'm about 7,000 or 8,000. I know I am almost 1,000 miles just from the edge of the Antarctic continent. And then from there, probably some hundreds of miles to South America. I think less than 1,000, then all of South America, which might be, say, 3,000 miles, and then all of North America up to LA. So something like 7,000 or 8,000. But I have to say, I don't know off the top of my head.
You are at the South Pole, which is a very few human beings can say that they've been.
Yeah, so there are some people who come over the summer, and then even fewer of them stay for the entire winter. It's been, I think, less than 2,000 people ever have stayed over the winter here. The winter season here runs about 10 months. 10 months, and then there's about 2 months of warmer temperatures where operations resume so that people can come in and out of the station for scientific and maintenance duties during the summer.
Yeah, so we're recording this right now on Tuesday, November 1st, which means you are towards the end of your stay at the South Pole. You're actually moving into summer now, aren't you?
That's right. So for the majority of winter, it was either completely dark or a small sort of twilight transition stage. And now we've moved into the completely light phase, past the sunrise, which took about a month for the sun to rise. And it's completely light out. And temperatures are a bit warmer. And you're not going to believe me when I say this is warmer, but it's now temperatures are in the minus 50s instead of, say, the minus 70s, 80s, 90s, and 100s.
But to a human body, I mean, is that really a perceptible difference, or is it all just death temperatures?
That was a big question before I came here, too. You know, can you really tell the difference? And I will say that you can't really tell the difference between minus 70 and minus 80. But what you can tell the difference is between the wind levels. So if it's minus 100 with no wind, it could just as well probably be minus 90. You know, it's colder than minus 50, but not exactly how much. But you can tell the difference between just a few miles per hour more wind. You can feel that. So I pay attention almost more to the wind than and the direction it's coming from than the temperatures themselves when I go out for a walk.
Interesting. And tell me if my assumption is correct in thinking that the core of the winter, which is kind of, well, you said it was 9 months, but the really dark, dark winter between April and August or April and September, is it the dark that is much more challenging than the cold, or are they pretty equally difficult to overcome?
I think a lot of people enjoy the darkness just psychologically here because we can see the stars and auroras, and the sky is changing quite a lot. The sky doesn't change too much when it's light all the time. And we can have small lights for navigation. We try to keep light pollution for a minimum, to a minimum for all the scientific experiments that are observing the auroras here. So because the lights are kind of to a minimum, sometimes if the wind is very high and because of that snow is blowing and the visibility is poor, the darkness can provide definitely an additional challenge, but there's a lot of navigational aids, flags, and stuff like that. So I think it definitely is the cold more than the dark that is the challenge, in that you do have to walk a little slower in the dark. But the darkness also has some psychological detriments, obviously, but it also has some benefits in that you do have the opportunity for this aurora kind of picture taking and watching. That's quite a lot of fun and provides some variety to people's lives here.
Ugh, must be absolutely incredible. And of course, we haven't even really dived in yet to what you do, but it would make sense. It's something I obviously just overlooked in my thinking. If it's dark all the time, the night sky must be absolutely stunning.
Yeah, so you can often see the Milky Way with your naked eye and see a lot of stars. And of course the auroras down here as well. And it's neat because they're kind of out all the time. So you don't have to think, oh, should I go out now? It's late. You can go stargazing just after lunch if you want.
That's incredible. But I would hope that indoors within the research station, there is some control over kind of therapeutic light. Do the lights turn off at a certain point at night? Do you try to keep some sort of cycle so that you actually have a circadian rhythm?
So the doctors and some people bring down lights that are colloquially known as happy lights, and they're kind of, things providing additional light mimicking sunlight. And some people use those while they work or to wake up in the morning. I personally have some bulbs from Philips Hue that connect to a base station that turn on and off at particular times. And I have them set up to simulate a sunrise when I wake up and kind of get dark and blue as I'm supposed to go to bed. The station runs on New Zealand time, where a lot of our planes in the summer and our logistics is coming from. The U.S. Antarctic Program has a center there. So we do have time, a standard time here, and most people operate under that time. Some people are on night shift for their jobs, and some of the scientists, as they are all over the world, have strange sleep schedules because their sleep schedules are more flexible, and also sometimes their experiments themselves demand a flexible sleep schedule just because of the times that they have to get up to maintain those.
Definitely. So it's just after 10:30 here in Los Angeles, 10:30 in the morning. You're on New Zealand time, so what time is it there at the station?
Right now it's 6:40 in the morning here, and we're actually a day ahead as well. So it's November 2nd here.
That's so crazy. You're time traveling.
yeah. Here in the future.
You're in the future. It's crazy. But you're such a wise sage. That's good. That's good. Yeah, you've overcome. Did you guys get to celebrate Halloween?
We did. We had actually, we were supposed to get some big planes bringing in about 40 people. We've been 48 people for the entire season, so that would almost double our population. Those planes were unfortunately delayed, but some smaller planes made it. So some of our winter crew has departed already, and some new crew has arrived, which provided just like a little bit more of, you know, we've been hanging out with each other for 10 months. So just having some new people here provided a little bit more of that kind of party atmosphere. We had a Halloween party, and we thought, a lot of people were saying, this is almost like a real party, you know?
And so, I mean, like you said, you've been wintering over. You've been wintering over with this core crew. That's a very small number of people. You're towards the end of your visit there at the station. It's November 1st for me, November 2nd for you. When are you intending on flying out?
Yeah, so if everything goes well, I'll be flying out from the South Pole on November 15th to McMurdo Station, which is closer to the coast, and then from McMurdo Station to New Zealand, to Christchurch, New Zealand, on the 16th of November. So I'll be off Antarctica on the 16th of November, and the lingo here is off ice. That is my off-ice date.
Nice. And that's actually a delay, is it not? You had intended to leave a little sooner in order to make a very important interview.
That's right. So in early October, I got a note from NASA saying, please call us back. And I had applied to be an astronaut. So I thought, maybe this is good news. And I called them, and they wanted to have me down for an interview. And the dates that they gave for their very, very last group of interviews, they bring in people in groups of 10 to kind of help schedule the astronauts who are meeting with you, as well as the other people who are doing tests. And I was going to be part of the very, very last group, which was at the end of October. And all our planes have so far been kind of pushed back due to mostly weather issues here that we've been having with visibility. So I wasn't able to get out of the station in time to make that interview in person. So I ended up just doing it via Skype. And I do have more things I can do to help prepare here for our summer crew. So I'm sticking around now until the 15th of November here at the South Pole.
That's wonderful. So what is a Skype connection like? I mean, we're Skyping right now, but we're doing a phone call. Are you on like a satellite phone?
Yeah, this is everything we have over here, internet-wise or phone-wise, is all via satellite. Mm-hmm. So for my Skype with NASA, there was actually an email sent out to the entire station that everyone should hold off using any form of internet if they could, for a period of an hour, and really arranged with everyone and with our IT support. There was also a machine where internet traffic from Skype was given priority over all other internet traffic for a temporary period. So no one Skypes on their individual machines, because they're your own machine, its traffic isn't really given priority. So the Skype is almost useless. But on this particular machine, it can be a little bit better. And the quality, I was looking at a room full of people, and I could tell people's hair color and maybe the color of the outfit that they were wearing and if they moved, but I couldn't see their faces or if their lips moved. So I did have to, early on in the Skype, people were talking, and I had to ask people, could you please say your name? Because I can't actually see visually who is talking here.
That's crazy. I wonder if you were the first astronaut interview via Skype from the South Pole that they've ever had?
As far as I can tell, I am. I don't have the details of the history. I'm sure NASA would know that. But just based on the logistics of talking with people, it seemed like I was the first person to be interviewed at the South Pole.
So cool. So, you know, you have a long and varied career, a really kind of breadth of interest that you've covered. And you're so young to have done so. You're obviously researching at the South Pole. You're an astrophysicist doing your research there. Are you studying? I was looking online to try and pinpoint. I'm assuming that you look at a lot of different things, but is your main goal there to study the cosmic microwave background radiation?
That's right. That's right. And we're here at the South Pole. There are quite a few telescopes studying the cosmic microwave background radiation here, because it's basically as close as we can get to space, which would be ideal observing conditions while still being here on Earth so that we can service the telescopes and operate them cheaply. So all these telescopes are here in Antarctica specifically because it's very high up. It's dry. Water vapor interferes with the observations, and Antarctica is actually a desert. It has very stable weather due to the fact that it's either all daylight or all darkness, basically, so you don't get a lot of temperature variation from that. And it's remote from other sources of interference for the observations.
And so you're there, you're doing these observations. You did your undergraduate work in actually way more than just physics. I'm seeing here you studied computer science and engineering and physics, also math and philosophy. You studied at MIT, then you went on to get a master's and a PhD. Where did you, that was overseas, right? Where did you complete your PhD?
That's right. So I went to Zurich in Switzerland for my master's, thinking that it'd be fun to have small experience abroad, and they had a great program there, and I ended up enjoying my research and my research group and the life in Switzerland so much that I stayed for a PhD, and I was based primarily in Zurich for about 6 years.
And what was the focus of your research there?
My focus of my research there, and then also now my work at Caltech, is much more computational, which is one of the reasons why it's been very cool to be here in Antarctica and actually be on the ground generating data that will eventually produce numbers that I would use in my computational research. So this cosmic microwave background radiation that we're observing here can give us information about how matter was distributed in the very early universe, shortly after the Big Bang, about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. And if we have information about how matter was distributed then, and we have all the equations of physics, then theoretically we could evolve those equations forward and see what happened next, and see galaxies eventually evolve and galaxy clusters, and see their interactions, and see if that simulation, which we perform on a computer, actually matches reality, not to the level that we're simulating an individual galaxy perfectly, but are we matching the statistical distribution of different types of galaxies? Does the formation history match what we see in the real universe? And if it doesn't match, why doesn't it match? Is it because we don't understand the equations correctly? Is it because we need better data constraints, et cetera? So it really helps with this interrogation of our theoretical framework about galaxies and galaxy formation, doing these simulations. And so that's a lot of what I did during my PhD, was run these cosmological simulations and ask specific questions about whether my simulation matched reality.
Gosh, it must be so cool to have spent so many years at doing this theoretical physics and diving into the math and into the computation, and then to have this incredible experience in this bizarro land collecting the data and seeing kind of the other side of that coin.
Yeah, and definitely, I mean, we do have some cool hardware in the computational end of things, supercomputers with many different machines interconnected and special cooling and bringing back computers that take up a room, that sort of stuff. But just seeing the telescope here, which is a 10-meter dish that's moving around in extreme temperatures, and all the setup and the electronics that take taking care of to keep it running and collecting the data, just generating one data set can require a team of people here, whereas that's something that sometimes a single graduate student can do in the computational field by themselves.
That's crazy. So, you know, obviously my connection to you is through Caltech. I have a lot of friends at Caltech. I'm an LA local now doing my SciComm work. Many of our sort of mutual friends have been on the podcast before. You are even engaged to one of my previous podcast guests, Casey Handmer, so which is great. And so you're a postdoc at Caltech right now, but you've taken sabbatical to go to Antarctica. Does the work that you're doing right now at the South Pole not count towards your postdoctoral work?
Well, my postdoctoral work is actually a specific grant to study one specific research question. So for my postdoc, I'm looking at, instead of galaxies and galaxy clusters, smaller objects, but still quite large. So looking at very, very massive stars in the early universe and how they behave, and making predictions there by doing simulations. And the work I'm doing here doesn't directly address that question. And in addition, I'm getting paid here, not by my fellowship, gotcha, but by the South Pole Telescope collaboration. So kind of collecting two salaries, you know, as fun as that might be, it wouldn't be ethical. So my fellowship did offer the provision for a one-year leave that a lot of scientists take to do kind of a different project and also get paid for that project, or handle family issues or travel. But the fellowship is quite a well-designed one by the National Science Foundation to really give people the freedom to develop their careers and their professional lives and their personal lives, you know, however they see fit. So that one-year provision was already written in that I could take up to a year of leave. So it was quite easy to kind of transition from one to the other and then transition back.
Gosh, what an incredible opportunity. And, you know, we talk a lot on the show, especially with graduate students or newly minted PhDs, about work-life balance. We talk a lot about what it means to be kind of transitioning in academia, maybe out of academia, if that's somebody's interest. And, you know, looking at your sort of resume, you would think that you just suck at work-life balance because you have done so much. But the truth of the matter is, when you dig a little bit deeper, you know, you are into kung fu. You read things that aren't even within the core subject matter of what you study. You study Chinese and you're engaged. You know, it seems like you're kind of figuring out the formula right now.
Yeah, I will say that before I got to Caltech, there were a few years where kind of things that were my hobbies had become my jobs. I had some hobbies helping out with app development kind of on the side, and those had sort of wedged their way in to become actually jobs on the side of my PhD. So for a few years there, I had much poorer work-life balance than when I got to Caltech. I decided, you know, I really have to not have two jobs, because having work-life balance when you have two jobs is very near impossible. I know many people have to do that just to make ends meet, but I did not have to. It was just something that I kind of fell into. But something that I've always had, you know, even throughout that, are these hobbies. And I think that has been one way that I was able to say, you know, to my coworkers at either job, hey, I can't work right now because I have this scheduled. So at first, those hobbies were, you know, kind of just ways of me taking a break without getting pushback from people I was working with. And that, you know, like, there's a class I'm going to between 8 and 9 p.m. I can't work between 8 and 9 p.m. But, you know, after I graduated with my PhD, I kind of took a step back and really stepped back from a lot of these extra work commitments. So now a lot of my hobbies are just, you know, not time scheduled. They're just, you know, whenever I want, because there's no one that I'm trying to kind of push back against. But my hobbies initially were probably ways of keeping work from expanding into every crevice of my life.
Yeah, and I think that that's, you know, it's necessary and it's incredibly sort of evolved, especially in academia, where I know it's a big struggle. I see it with a lot of my friends allowing work, and just, and it's not just academia, but it, there is definitely, I feel like, a certain personality type that's drawn to that, and it can be all kind of encompassing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't want to get too personal. I don't like diving into somebody's personal life unless it's something that's important and interesting for them to be able to tell. But because you are engaged to a friend of mine, Casey, and you guys obviously knew each other first, I became Casey's friend more over the past year while you were away. And so I've heard so much about you, and I can't wait to actually spend time with you once you get back. How did he take it when you told him that you were leaving? Because that's a pretty atypical engagement 9 months apart while you're at the South Pole.
So actually, before we even started dating, we were friends for a while and shared a lot of the same interests. And at some point, we were talking about dating, and I told him, I just find it really hard to date because I'm pretty sure I'm going to be going to the South Pole next year. I haven't gotten a job yet, but, you know, I'm really gunning to get the job and I have a good shot, I think. And if I go, I'm going to be gone for, you know, 10, 11 months, and starting a relationship right before that just seems too complicated. And he said something like, oh, well, why would that matter? You're an amazing person. And of course, any guy who dated you would wait. And so I've kind of made him, since we've started dating, really live by those words. But it was something that was on the cards, on the table before we started dating. So it's, of course, not easy, but it wasn't a surprise to either of us. It was something that we could kind of gradually work through and discuss and figure it out.
Oh, that's incredible. And as difficult as it must be so nice on the really hard days, knowing what you get to come home to.
Yeah, I'm very excited to get back to Casey and to all my friends and to the California weather. And there's a lot that when I think about it, I'm like, oh, you know, it's just great to have such a different situation than when I first moved to LA many years ago, where I was a few years ago, 2014, where I was excited, but I didn't really have like a home feeling to it. And now I really feel like I'm going home.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was in Manchester in the United Kingdom for a kind of skeptic, atheist, and science conference. And I had the pleasure of spending a little bit of time with Dr. Carl, the science communicator from Australia, huge in Australia. And somehow you came up and he was asking if you, because we were talking about astronaut interviews, I think. And I was like, I know somebody who's, you know, who's like keeps making it through the kind of callbacks. And he asked if you had joined, I'm probably going to butcher this, is there like a 100 club, something where you go from like a hot tub to outside to take your body 100 degrees Fahrenheit? Is that a thing?
So it's, even more extreme than that. It's called the 300 Club.
300?
And you take your body through 300 degrees of temperature change. There is a sauna here at the South Pole. There's not a hot tub. We try to conserve water, but there is a sauna. Which is especially good if you come in from the cold and just had a hard day, and to sit in the sun is a great experience since we can't take baths here, really. We take 2-minute showers, and we get 2 a week. So
no, so very, you just never wash your hair.
Basically, I cut my hair very short to begin with, and dry shampoos are quite popular down here. But yeah, so back to this 300 club. So you sit in the sauna for as long as you can stand it, get your body very, very hot, and then you go outside and you walk to the official geographic pole, which is probably a few hundred feet from the station, after a 4-story climb in a very cold stairwell. And you're doing all of this, the traditional way to do it is with shoes only. You can't walk in naked feet because your feet would freeze to the ground. And people do this. So there are many members of the 300 Club, and I'm proud to say I'm also a member.
No way. Is it dangerous? It sounds very dangerous to me.
It is not dangerous. Of course, sitting in a sauna for that long, many people do it just recreationally, even if it's not for the 300 Club, but you'll get hot. But really, you don't get cold enough as you're walking out there because of your experience in the sauna. It's really not that bad.
Oh, that's crazy. It must feel insane. Like, there must be some sort of weird invincibility feeling that you have because you've preheated yourself and now you're outdoors in, what were you saying was the temperature? You know, negative 70, negative
minus
60.
100.
Minus 100. Oh my God.
Yeah, this is done in kind of the coldest portion. So there's only a few days per year, maybe 7 to 10 days per year where it gets below minus 100. And the 300 Club is done, when it's done in these especially cold temperatures.
That is so crazy. But also such a point of pride because there can't be that many people in the world who have ever done this.
That is certainly true. Even the people who come down here, I would say it's probably only a portion of the crew that gives this a try. And some people, just take it as they want. They'll go in the sauna and they'll stand outside for a minute instead of walking all the way to the pole. So there are different kind of 300 Club light options.
So you've been there, pushing 9 months. Maybe is it over 9 months or is it right around 9 months now?
Right now I'm just over 10 months.
Over 10 months. Jeez. So you've been there almost an entire year of your life. What is a typical day like for you? Is it just grind away at the work, wake up at the same time, have a routine and try to stick to that so you don't go mad? Or is it really varied and really exciting to dive into your work every day?
For me, it's pretty varied. I have a collaborator who helps me run the telescope, Amy Lowitz, and she's doing her PhD, just finishing up her PhD, and we'll be doing a postdoc with the South Pole Telescope Collaboration. And Amy and I share duties for the telescope. So one of us has to go out and walk to the telescope every single day, which is about 2/3 of a mile from the station, and do rounds and inspections and maintenance tasks there. And so if it's a day that it's my turn to walk out there, that's something that I usually do. After the internet, we have only a portion of the day where we have internet access. So during internet access hours, often I'm doing more computational work or analysis work on the data, just because it's nice to do that while you have Google and data services available. And so the schedule kind of varies around when internet access is, and most of those internet access windows move by 4 minutes earlier every day. Which seems like it wouldn't be much, but it adds up to half an hour a week or an hour every 2 weeks, the internet schedule moves. So my schedule gradually changes over time. And on the days I have where I'm not required to go out to the telescope, sometimes I do anyway because we have tasks that we have to do together. Like the other day, we parked the telescope and climbed up in it to inspect some cables, and we did that task, of course, together. Or in addition, we switch off on-call periods, which basically means we have a pager of sorts that will call us if any number of alarms trip outside of acceptable bounds on the telescope. And if it's your turn on call, just like a doctor, you're a telescope doctor for that week, then even if it's in the middle of the night, you get up, you gear up. If it's requiring you to go out to this telescope, and you go out there and fix it right away. So that provides a lot of variety.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. You do. Do you have to kind of like alert people that you're is there a way for people to know that you're there? So if something goes wrong, they're aware and they can come intervene?
We do have the option of checking in. There's someone always on duty in our weather department, and they kind of do double duty, as you can call them either on the phone, or we have radio systems here, which are kind of like our cell phones. And you can call them on the radio and say, I'm going out. And people do that usually during times of like poor visibility, or if they're doing a more elaborate walk. But just the walk out to the telescope, it takes about 15 minutes. And you do have a radio with you, so you could call for help if something happened. And it's also very well marked. So it's not something that people typically call for, but there definitely is the option of calling, and people always have their radios on for safety here. And you can call basically 911 or everyone on the station from your radio if you needed to. If for some reason, like you lost your glove and your fingers got really cold, you could, alert people that you're having a problem. And, that's kind of a contrived situation because you could basically just stick your arm in your coat. But, if you twisted your ankle or something where you really couldn't walk. And we have everyone here trains as part of an emergency response team. So we have four different teams of well-trained people. And we do drills every month that can incorporate anything from medical emergencies to fire emergencies. And you can certainly call for help, and people will be there for you.
That's good. So you've got basic safety covered. You've probably got, like you said, emergencies, fire control, resuscitation, CPR. I'm assuming that you have a pharmacy there or a small stash with basic needs being able to be met. But what happens if there is a somewhat more complicated medical emergency? I mean, especially if you're there during this winter over, like you mentioned, planes can't get in. You've had to push back your NASA interview multiple times because you couldn't get out. You couldn't get off ice.
Yeah.
What happens if somebody, has a cardiac arrest or a stroke or breaks, has an open fracture or gets a really bad infection?
So we do have a medical clinic here, and we have an on-site doctor and also a physician's assistant over the winter. And mostly they're dealing with, everyday injuries, sprains, bruises, cuts, abrasions, just minor things. But they are also trained and equipped to deal with more major emergencies. They're not able to do major surgery because we don't have the equipment, but they could do, for example, a minor operation or something like remove an appendix if they needed to, if they absolutely needed to. But we actually do have some basic equipment for medicines for handling something like a cardiac arrest. And in fact, in this very winter, there was someone who had a heart attack. They were treated and were doing fine. And then there was someone else who had a more major medical issue that they actually decided they did not have the resources to treat locally. And so they decided they were going to evacuate both these people at the same time and did send a plane. And we were very lucky that the plane only took about 7 days to get here, because with weather delays, it could have taken even longer. And we were lucky to be able to evacuate both those people in the first ever midwinter evacuation. But that was because the temperatures and just the weather kind of cooperated, that they were able to get out so quickly, where quick is, you know, still taking about a week.
Crazy. No, I remember that. It was international news. You know, the details were a little fuzzy, but I definitely remember that story and everybody covering it, because it was, like you said, it was the first ever. It was so fascinating and it was very scary, you know. But I guess that is sort of a risk that you assume when you decide to sign up to go to someplace that's so remote and that's so unforgiving.
That is right. And then they also do extensive medical tests as part of what they call a physical qualification procedure, where they take a lot of blood samples and do a lot of inspections and ultrasounds. And so they try to rule out any sort of problem that might not be a major problem when you're close to a major hospital, but could become a major problem here. So they try their best to do that, but there are some things that you just can't necessarily predict, or that happen as the result of, you know, some sort of accident. And they are prepared to really give people a high quality of care here, and then when absolutely necessary, try their best to get them out.
Well, and in some ways, it's almost like the very, very intense training wheels for what one of your kind of lifelong goals has been, which would be to go to space, because it's just that much more difficult to overcome some of these kinds of issues when you are in isolation on a space station, or even potentially, you know, doing a pioneering mission like going to Mars, which is actually on the table for a modern astronaut.
Yeah, certainly there's a lot of similarities between deployment here and a potential long-term mission. I hope that we have a base as well fitted out as the one at the South Pole one day on Mars. We have a lot of amenities here at the South Pole, and I think that the initial Mars explorers will be much more like camping, which is a lot of fun too, but also provides increased dangers. Here we have a lot of safety net with all the infrastructure here and the extra fuel that we have and the building that we have to live in and everything like that.
So you are, you know, you're actively applying to become an astronaut. That's on top of all of the incredible training that you have done in astrophysics, the work that you have done, like you said, in computer science and app development, and all of the other interesting sort of paths that your life has taken. I could say without a shadow of a doubt, unequivocally, that I would never in a million years want to board a ship to go to Mars. I also don't think I would be wanted by NASA. I don't think I would have too much to offer them. But as an astrophysicist, and as somebody obviously with a very good health record, and somebody who has this open-ended passion for exploration, is that on your bucket list? Is that something you really want to do?
That's something I really want humanity to do. So I'm not even sure. You know, right now, that's so much up in the air that I'm willing to devote a good portion of my life to try to encourage that to happen. And the fact that it could happen in our lifetime, I think, is just amazing and inspiring. I think we have a very narrow window as humans to try to do that. You know, if we try to do it 200 years from now, it could be that we haven't quite figured out the energy problem, or that civil unrest or changing nation states just make it not make sense. Right now, we have all the resources intellectually, physically. We have basically the technology. There's, of course, developments we need to do, but there are fewer developments, I believe, that we need to do than when we committed to go to the moon, between that period and us actually going to the moon. So I think it's certainly achievable, and we just need the political will. So I really want to encourage that to happen. You know, whether I go or not, I would definitely be interested in going personally. And so that could be on the table, but for me, the more important and deeper level is just encouraging, you know, anyone on Earth to go at all.
Yeah. So serious, not serious, but is your amygdala broken? Do you have no fear?
I actually have a very measured approach to risk. So I feel like, and a friend of mine who does, she does a lot of like tightrope walking and stuff like that. I talked to her about her approach to risk. And, you know, I think that I have similar answers in that, you know, everything I do, I'm very well trained to do. And there are, of course, risks outside of my control. You know, like for example, with rocket technology or whatever, but whatever is in my control, I'm very meticulous about doing things in the right way to minimize risk, to be safe in the event that, you know, you have to call something off or you have to have a hard conversation about let's not do this today, not having peer pressure there and just kind of making the safe decision. There are things that are outside of my control. But there's a lot of uncertainty in life. You know, people can die in car accidents. They can die, you know, from cancer. They can die from old age. There's a variety of ways that humans can die, and you can't necessarily predict that. And, you know, I know that NASA and other companies are also people involved in space are as obsessive about trying to minimize risk on that system level as I am about, you know, the small details that I can control. So everyone's doing their best. And for me, it's something that's so important that, you know, one human life, even if that's my own, is nothing compared to trying to encourage and enable humanity to study and branch out from our own Earth.
Wow, that's such a great perspective. You know, you're very isolated where you are, and, you know, we're able to talk right now on this satellite connection. You said that the internet is not amazing and it's really limited. Do you have access to any sort of entertainment while you're there? Did you have a chance? I can't remember if it came out before you got there or not, but did you have a chance to see The Martian yet?
It did come out before I got here, and I did have a chance to see that several times. It's a great film. We do have access to entertainment here, so there's a huge media library that has a lot of DVDs and other things, and for people who play video games, lots of video games, and there's a huge library with books. And people, in addition, have their own electronic devices, you know, tablets or Kindles or computers, and they might have some of their own content on those that they can consume. About midwinter, we got access to an additional satellite that was quite fast, much faster than we were used to. And we were actually allowed for the first time to legally, of course, you know, via iTunes or Amazon or whatever, download movies. And so there were some movies that came out on DVD just before we got here that we finally were able to get and watch. And in addition, for some people, Star Wars came out while they were down here. And Disney was nice enough to give McMurdo and the South Pole access to a special copy of legal viewing Star Wars so that we could have it kind of in our cinema here. We have in the gym a big sheet put up that we can put a projector on and kind of set it up like a movie theater. And so people were able to watch Star Wars down here, even though it wasn't on DVD yet, which was really neat.
Oh, wow. That must have been so special. You know, when I think about...
Sure.
when I think about The Martian, I feel like it was a very evolved story, obviously, and it was a really great piece of science fiction that was quite realistic in most aspects. And there it passed the Bechdel test, which I absolutely loved. But the core character was still male, Mark Watney. Mm-hmm. And unlike Mark Watney, you, of course, are female. And one thing that I think is so inspiring about you, about your interests, about your work, is that you don't stay siloed in the scientific perspective. And what I mean by that is that you look at science's place in the greater picture, and you care about issues like diversity, like gender, like LGBTQ rights, you know, civil justice. And these are things that matter to you as a scientist, but also as a human. How do you balance all of those approaches and keep your interests top level like that? How do you stay interested in politics? How do you stay interested in the human experience while also doing things that many of us would think of as being all-consuming, like computational, you know, theoretical astrophysics?
Yeah, I don't necessarily have the ability to turn just one side of my brain off. And it is something that I care deeply about, making a better world. And I think that feeds back into science. You know, if we have a healthier society, we'll have healthier science and healthier scientific progress. So I think it's all interrelated and tied together. And, you know, I don't really judge or blame people who just want to focus on one or the other or one sort of narrow component, because there's just so much work to be done that it's hard to focus on more than one thing at once. For me personally, just the way that I work, I enjoy working on many different projects at once. And, you know, different phases of projects also have different kind of levels of impact that you feel that you're making. So when you're right in the middle of a scientific piece of research, you know, you're the only one who might be seeing it. So it feels very, you know, like narrowed and cloistered. So I very much like to balance that with, you know, more interaction, you know, whether that's with science communication, whether that's talking about science work that I've done previously, or whether that's working on all these social issues that I feel do feed back eventually into the science, and vice versa, that scientific progress, you know, doesn't always, but it has the possibility of making, you know, our lives much richer and, you know, extending our lifespan and making it so that people have more leisure time to devote to whatever they find meaningful in their lives. And some people will devote that to more science. Other people will do art projects. Other people will surf the internet. But just having more agency in our lives, that's something that science can help enable. So I think it all feeds together. And for me, I'm privileged and burdened with having the type of brain that, you know, I can't just work on one thing at once. So I try to attack sort of the same sets of issues from a variety of perspectives.
Yeah, you know, you absolutely live in the right era for your disposition, your temperament, your personality, because the type of strong, progressive, outspoken woman that you are would have been absolutely suppressed even more than, you know, women deal with now in academia and it kind of in the world at large, even just a decade ago. Do you find that your approach, though, and your ability to be outspoken and your ability to think about these social issues and to actually make sure your voice is heard, especially when it comes to gender discrimination or harassment within these kind of institutional settings, do you find that you get any blowback from that? Or have you generally found that in your career, people have been supportive?
I personally have found that people have been supportive, but it has been the case that, you know, I'm active on other people's causes. So I don't necessarily always, you know, there's some distance between me and the work that I'm doing. That's not to say that these issues don't affect me as well. It's just that that's my personal approach to things. Largely, I brought in a couple of personal stories. You know, it's not an issue that I have escaped entirely, but it's something that I try to empower other people, and I've learned something from my personal experiences. But I haven't had a huge amount of blowback, though I think that I, like everyone else who is in, you know, some sort of situation where they could be the whistleblower on something, would of course get blowback for that.
Yeah, you know, and it must have been a difficult 10 months in that respect, just because of all of the, and we don't, you know, need to get into the brass tacks of it or the nitty gritty, but all of the news that we have been seeing about, you know, not just gender discrimination, but overt harassment and really abuse within these academic institutions. It's nothing new, but there have been a lot of stories over the past few months regarding people that we know personally, people that are near and dear to our hearts, and some of the real struggles that they've been dealing with as women in these institutions that are historically male-dominated and historically misogynistic.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the big challenge, like one of the benefits for academia and academic life, is the freedom that individuals have to kind of make their own way, as opposed to a corporation, which might have more of a top-down structure. But that freedom has also meant that there isn't a lot of oversight or training for people who are put in leadership roles to really handle those effectively, and for people who are, you know, just training to go into leadership roles later to have an avenue to know what's appropriate and to be able to work in an environment that's, you know, supportive. I think industry has a lead on academia. There are a lot of things that I see happening in academia. If someone did that in industry or, you know, in any corporation or in government, they would long be fired.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it doesn't help when you are coming up through academia and, you know, the people who are in these leadership positions have never, they're just not very varied in terms of gender or ethnicity. And so when, you know, your PI was a white male and his PI was a white male and his PI was a white male, it's hard to have that kind of training. It's hard to have that perspective. But beyond that, you know, we're running low on time on your connection. And I have, of course, squeezed every possible second out of you. So forgive me for that. It's been such an incredible chat. But before we go, I close every interview asking my guests the same two questions. And I know that your answers are going to blow me away, so I'm no pressure, but I'm really excited to hear what you have to say. So those two questions are this. When you look towards the future, in whatever context that means for you, whether it's your personal future, your professional future, or sort of the future of humanity and the globe at large and beyond, number one, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night, most preoccupies you, worries you the most? And on the flip side of that, so that we end on a more positive note, what are you the most hopeful and excited and optimistic for?
Yeah, those are really good questions. I feel like you warned me about those ahead of time, but we've been trying to schedule this call for about a month now with, you know, your travel schedule and my canceled travel plans and that sort of stuff. I think issues of social justice and income inequality, I think, are some of the biggest things that kind of keep me up at night in terms of challenges I think we'll face in the future. I think that even though I am now privileged enough to be, you know, part of a small percentage of society that has the luxury to travel via airplane and do kind of knowledge-based careers and that sort of stuff. It's not only, you know, just selfishly in my benefit and people who have that ability in their benefit to bring other people, to bring all of society up to that level. And I think that we have, you know, again, the technology and the ability to do that, and we just need the organization and the logistics and the will to do something like that. And I think that those issues long-term could be very destabilizing, and it's just completely depressing to see that, you know, this is potentially a solved problem. There yeah. are places in the world that have been able to handle this little pocket. And we just have to figure out how to expand those pockets around the world. What I'm most excited about is that I think that there's, you know, a lot of changes scientifically that have been brewing for a while, whether that's in quantum computing or artificial intelligence, increased processor speeds, a variety of things. And, you know, as well, we're well overdue for some breakthroughs in theoretical physics. And this whole maybe we'll go to Mars thing. I think the next 50 years will be, you know, even if you're just a ghost from the past observing it, you know, there'll be a lot of discoveries and really interesting things to come in the next 50 years that have kind of been brewing. Brewing for a while. So I think that'll be really, really interesting. I think it's a cool time to be alive and be an appreciator of science, more or less someone who has a small contribution to it.
Absolutely. I am definitely looking forward to seeing what the future brings as well. And it's in no small part because of people like you actually making the future. You know, it doesn't happen passively. It's an active process. And so I think in many ways, kind of those of us who consider ourselves to be part of the general public owe you a debt of gratitude for the work that you do. Christine, let everyone know how they can follow your work and learn more about everything that you do. I know that you have a newsletter. Is it possible for people to get back issues of that so they can see all of your excitement over the course of your South Pole winter over, or you know, how can people catch up on your story if they hadn't been aware of you up until now?
Sure. Well, the best place to start out is on Twitter. I'm at Corbett, Corbett, and that links to my website, which links to my newsletter and has, you know, all sorts of information about what I've been up to. As for the newsletter, that's a good idea. It's something that I will consider. So far, it's kind of been so subscribers only, because I really wanted to have, you know, the freedom to talk more intimately. And especially when you're down here with such a small population, you don't necessarily want everything highly accessible on the web. But it's something I will consider collecting those experiences. And I don't know if that will be releasing, you know, the back issues, or maybe having like a giant compilation that sort of edits out the highlights, but I will see. So that's certainly something that I will consider, and people are welcome to subscribe. Through the end of 2016, I'll be talking about Antarctica stuff only, and then beginning in 2017 on my newsletter, I'll probably be hopefully talking about a lot of space-related stuff.
Very, very cool. Well, Christine, thank you so much for taking time out of your incredibly busy schedule to chat with us today. I learned so much and I had an absolute blast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I had a very good time as well, and I'm glad that the satellite connection was cooperative.
Oh, it was amazing. I'm blown away by how good our connection was. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.